you may be wondering why Professor of Commercial Law is chairing this final session. Well, I think the answer's fairly obvious, that the abolition of slavery was one of the first commercial social responsibility issues in the modern economy and society. But I'm not here to give a speech, I'm here simply to coordinate the last session. But we have three discussants who have been given 5 minutes each, I'm afraid, only, to make a presentation. And they are Marcus Goffey, who's an attorney at law in Jamaica and a legal advisor to the Ethno-Africa Diaspora Union Millennium Council. Then Christine Shields, a fellow of the Queen Mary Centre for Commercial Law Studies. And finally, Darren Kelly, a lecturer in the School of Law, Essex. And could I ask Marcus to kick us off?
Yes, and Chadwick. Well, thanks for being here. I would just like to start off with the World Conference Against Racism, which really, as Professor Van Boven said, was very pivotal in the process. And in fact, what came out of that conference was a recommendation that there be a international tribunal to measure the extent of the damages resulting from the slave trade and from the slavery process. And I think that what has transpired from the discussion today has really been, for me, telling in terms of the process that the Jewish communities have used to come to some concrete results. And the Rastafari community, you know, in Jamaica has been involved in the struggle for reparations, and in particular for repatriation as a feature of reparations for many decades. And so we'd like to really see some sort of tangible result in the near future. So to that end, I will just briefly highlight what I see as being the steps in the right direction. Mr. Nathan suggested that the question should be asked, how can political pressure be mounted to get funds to get the reparations? He asked further that can this be done without powerful partners who can be induced to do something to remedy the crime? And so I think that we need to go outside of the scope of theory and to get into a process which can actually do the historical research, as Professor Shelton pointed out, is necessary, as well as to bring together the skills of persons from within the continent, from within the diaspora, and from within the general community of nations who feel a willingness and an ability to contribute in that process. But we need to get in a tangible form where it can be the end result being a sort of documentation of the needs and of the desires, and then formulate into now a strategy. Now that leads me to the question of whether it should be a litigation process or a diplomatic process. And as a lawyer, you know, the starting point is always to approach these issues in a consultative, you know, an amicable fashion before really resorting to litigation. I think that is also true here, and that, you know, that is also the reason why there needs to be a coordinated political group that can politically pressure the nations to come to some concrete resolution as to how this thing can be resolved. For it's a fact that we can't really move forward in terms of breaking down the barriers to racism and so forth until we can overcome the historical differences, and that's very important. So finally, to be brief, I think that the AU right now is the correct vehicle to move forward in this process. The AU has recently opened up a 6-region diaspora reasoning, which is aimed at integrating the diaspora into the mainstream of the AU process. And I think that is the correct framework for these recommendations and strategies to come to bear real fruit. Through the AU process, I think that the 6-region can play an important role, and that can also assist in the wider European and the Americas and the Jewish community being invited to help the Africans and Afro descendants to really bear some real fruit out of this process. That's my few words.
Thank you very much. Could I now call on Christine Shields?
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here. I would like to pick up on the suggestion made today that fair trade may be considered as a form of reparation. And at the same time, I'll describe or perhaps just hint at some of the work of the HRC Fair Trade Research Project, which is a collaborative research project with academics from the University of Essex, Queen Mary and the European University Institute. So I'd like to start by saying that whilst it is tempting to consider the fair trade movement as a form of reparation, this conceptualisation is problematic on a variety of levels. First of all, assuming that we could overcome the fact that this reparation is issued from the informal institution of civil society rather than a governmental authority, assuming that this redirected responsibility would be maybe acceptable as a legitimate form of reparation to those who seek the reparation, still the reality remains that fair trade simply does not do enough to rectify the harms created by slavery. I would argue that fair trade represents a model for compliance with international labour standards, and it does not offer solutions to remedy entrenched injustices or structural inequalities. I would like to furnish this with a report from someone while I was in South Africa on a field trip with the project, but I'll save that for the writing for the moment as we push for time. I'll finish on a more optimistic note by suggesting that although fair trade may not offer a form of reparation, it nevertheless may represent a form of protest against modern forms of slavery as unfree labour. For lest we forget, although slavery has been abolished as a legal institution, it continues to exist in the modern economy as an informal institution.
The speakers are all keeping within the very tight time limits, and I now pass to Darren Kelly.
Up till now, they have me.
That's why I'm chair.
In 5 minutes, I'd just like to distill down a few of the very basic principles that my simple lawyer's brains managed to digest today. As a simple lawyer, I like to look at things in very stage-by-stage, on a stage-by-stage basis. We always look for a wrongful act. We always look for a perpetrator and a victim. We always look for some result, some form of redress. Now, I think today there's been quite a lot of focus on the notion of the wrongful act. Was slavery a crime at the time it was committed? There's been quite a lot said on that. Dinah Shelton mentioned that the notion that there could be no legitimate expectation of reliance on an unjust act at the time. Professor Van Boven mentioned this notion of crimes against humanity, which are crimes now and always have been. These seem to have been the issues affecting the minds of the Nuremberg judges. Mention was made of the retrospective nature of the Nuremberg trials in the 1945-1946 era. The fact that justice allows for a sympathetic reading of legal principle, if you like, is demonstrated by Nuremberg. I don't think we should get too het up about this notion of considering whether or not it was a crime at the time. It was a wrong. It was so horribly wrong that no one at the time, and there was evidence of people at the time making this point, no one should rely on it and should not use that as an excuse to do nothing. More troubling, however, in my perspective is who can now bring the claims, against who, and what for. Clearly, on a simple level, we could say that the descendants of those stolen from Africa should bring a claim against those who are now profiting. The problem is there's so much that's happened in the meantime. As a lawyer, we always look for a causative link, we look for an unbroken chain of causation. Unfortunately, we have hundreds of years of what we call novus actus interveniens, things that have happened in the meantime which are going to negatively and positively affect that chain of causation. So I think in terms of reparations for slavery, we have to bear that in mind, even if we can show a factual link, even if the genealogy of an individual can be traced back to that moment in time when their when the future generations were affected. What else has happened? What else breaks that chain of causation? I would like to think of, sadly have to think of slavery in terms of the larger ill of colonialism. I don't think it's been addressed overly today. Colonialism, the evil perhaps of the theft of Africa and its resources, would be more amenable, if you like, to this chain of causation. We can see how the great powers went into Africa, perhaps, and stole its natural resources and took the pride of its young men and women away. That ended relatively recently, and it may have a more tangible effect on Africa now. So perhaps if we consider colonialism as a whole, rather than slavery as our driving force, perhaps it'd be easier to come up with some answers in that way. Very, very finally, the backdrop there has the past hyphenated. No one today has yet mentioned it, but we can't be blind to the fact that the international laws which were allowed the trade in slaves across the Atlantic Ocean, the laws of the sea, are still applicable today. We still have laws of the sea which can be interpreted in a way which subjugates many, many people to bonded labour, almost slave conditions. And so until we look at that issue, I don't think we can call ourselves particularly evolved. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you. Fern, would you like to say a few words now?
I'll finish off to you.
Okay, right. As I say, I haven't been at the conference today, but I'm already picking up so many important issues. The institutional forum in which one should deal with these questions, is litigation a correct response? Does the market, through fair trade, offer us something? What sort of justifications do we have for responses? And if we take the legacy of colonialism, then I've written down at least four questions here. Questions of how we cooperate for the development of former colonial countries. Do we institutionalise special and preferential treatment on not just on grounds of economic development, but on the grounds of historical justice and equity, which gives a very different dimension to special and preferential treatment in trade terms, if we look at it that way. Another issue is possibly how do we ensure that former colonial territories preserve a genuine right to regulate in relation to foreign trade and investment, so that past exploitation does not continue into the future. And finally, how do we use labour rights in order to protect and further the goal of never allowing slavery to take full hold? And what strikes me here is an anecdote that I read about a year ago, where I found that the largest number of de facto slaves is still to be found in Brazil, one of the most eagerly and swiftly industrialising countries in the world. And this is just quite staggering. Anyway, those are some thoughts that I've picked up from our panel. And now it's my duty to open to the floor for questions for about 15 minutes, or have we got five? Only 5 minutes, because we have to be out of here before six. Yes?
Yeah, I think by 10 to.
Sorry. Can I just say that I've enjoyed the conference immensely. It's what got the order for me. But some of closing remarks that I've just heard indicates that there is a tendency, and please don't be offended by this, there's a tendency to cop out on what the substantive issues are. I think, I didn't get your name.
Cynthia.
You made a very, very wonderful point their truth commission. We do not know what happened. We think we do. All of us have part of the story. If we're going to move forward with addressing the ills of slavery in terms of reparations, in terms of defining what those reparations should be, we have to decide who did what to whom and why. Surely. Now, can we say that we know this? And if we do not know this, shouldn't we attempt to know it? Which seems to me that the most important point of this conference is a call for inquiry into slavery. Call it transatlantic slavery. If you want to frame it another way, fine. But we need to find out who are the main players in this. Who did what to whom and why? Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves paying reparations to people who caused slavery and people who participated in it. And to me, that is an insult to my ancestors. I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend you. But you need to have an inquiry into what happened.
Thank you. Because we're going to run out of time, can I just quickly respond? And Rhoda would like to respond to the comment. And there are a number of people, for example, Esther Stanton, what people are saying is being curtailed because of time. But that's one of the things on the agenda. One of the things we're trying to do is set up some kind of experts by experience group, advisory group, which has on board a number of people. It isn't just an academic enterprise. So I hear absolutely what you're saying. And the conference is the beginning of a discussion. It's not the end. So it's important to take that on board. Rhonda, would you just like to...
I'm sorry, so I know this sounds like a commercial, but in my book, Reparations to Africa, outside, Chapter 3 discusses Durban. Chapters 5 to 7 discuss the problem of economic history. Chapter 11 discusses the possibility of a truth commission. Chapter 10 discusses apologies. And it has the voices to answer Esther of the 74 Africans from the continent of Africa, whom I and my assistants interviewed in great detail, all for the same reason as a beginning of this kind of debate, or to help a beginning of this debate.
So this is all good. This is all good. This is all good that different people, academics, policymakers, diplomats, students, importantly, and so on, the eminence speakers come together to start airing these issues. Have you got anything to say before I close? Because I'm going to have to close. Peter?
I'd just say that I'm sure that no one on the panel would take offence at all at what you say. I think quite the contrary. In my own field, I'd be very interested to find out more of the details about which British multinationals, we all know the names, I think, have actively profited from the slave trade and reinvested those profits to become global players. And this is a very real question that we could inquire into, and business historians have a role to play in this. So I think it's a perfectly sensible additional point to this endeavour.
Okay, one more 30-second comment.
Yeah, 30-second comment would be this morning, I think a number of us identified a tension between, on the one hand, international law, on the other hand, a concept of justice. And I think I just want to observe another tension I think has arisen. We saw particularly with Esther's presentation, which is whether we think international law is a vehicle for emancipation or whether we think international law is part of the problem here. We've seen law as a legitimizer of colonialism and slavery, and we also see law as human rights and the human rights story as something that offers promise and hope of some sort of reparation. But I think that's a tension we have to acknowledge up front. We can't just assume international law is a solution.
Good. One more?
Going to direct people to the university, WISE, the World Cross Institute for Study, Emancipation and Enslavement and Emancipation. That's a very good economic history perspective. So in terms of the research inquiry that you just mentioned, that perhaps might be a good starting point.
Okay, great, thank you. I would like to thank very special thanks, if that's all right, Peter.